Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Paul Krugman, whose latest book is The Conscience of a Liberal. Paul Krugman is a New York Times op-ed columnist and economist, teaches at Princeton University, author of several books, including The Great Unraveling. This particular book, Conscience of a Liberal, let's start with the title. It's based, insofar as I can see, on two books. One was Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, and the other was John W. Dean's Conservatives Without Conscience.
Well, yes, there's all of that, yeah. I obviously don't like where Goldwater pointed, but he did. His book did mark the beginning of a great turn in American politics to the right, and I'm hoping and to some extent predicting that that's over. So this book is intended in that sense to be like Goldwater's, and in that sense only, I think is the word.
Well, first let's talk about your theses a bit here in the book. There was a review that was in the New York Times, and it struck me that there were a few cases where I think you could probably elaborate. A lot of it, though, and I want to get into that, seems to reflect a certain kind of conventional wisdom being masked as fact.
Yeah, and I think in some ways the highest tempers I've discovered in these dark years that we've been through come from people who are not actually all that conservative, but have been trying to poo-poo what's happening, and what they hate most is the people who actually had the courage to speak out and say, hey, this is really bad, and got it right. So anyway, yeah. We've had a sharp conservative turn in American politics, and we've also had a sharp increase in income inequality. We've seen, you know, we are when people talk about a second Gilded Age, that is not a metaphor. It's not hyperbole. It's by the numbers. We're back in the Gilded Age. We really are back in those levels of inequality. So in my book, I argue really two things. One is that a lot of the surge in inequality, this return, you know, basically, we've had 35 years of economic progress, which somehow hasn't trickled down to most people. It's all gone to a few people at the top. A lot of that has political origins. It really is, because of the growing right-wing dominance of American politics. And the other is that the people who took over, the movement conservatives, are, you know, that they've been gotten where they have by exploiting some of the darker strains in American life, not by winning the argument on the issues, but by, you know, selling things above all race.
Before we go specifically into the thesis of the book, there's a column by David Brooks which seemed to express surprise, saying that Americans seem very satisfied today, and yet at the same time they're unsatisfied with the government. That's odd, because I don't feel that.
I don't think that's right at all. I think people are, you know, most people are managing, and if you ask, are you doing okay, they'll say yes. If you ask, are you sure that you will continue to do okay, they say no, because they're aware that ours has become a very insecure society. That one illness that your insurance company, if you have one, won't really actually cover all the costs of, one spouse losing a job can really hurtle you, even if you have what looks like a solidly middle-class existence, can hurtle you over the edge. I don't see that. And by the way, polls don't show anti-government sentiment. The polls show that people are now once again looking for the government to do things to improve our lives. It's, you know, this is the line that the right has been trying to push, and they themselves keep on saying the government can't do anything, and they project that onto the population, but it's not there for real.
Well, they also prove it by doing nothing.
Well, that's the wonderful thing if you're a right winger. You can say totally fail to rescue a drowning city, and then say, see, I told you government doesn't work.
How conscious do you think that is?
Oh, and some of it's quite conscious, quite deliberate. I mean, you know, did they deliberately set out to let a city drown? Not exactly, but did they gut FEMA? Did they gut the agencies because they really don't care about governing well? Yes, for sure. And there are some programs. Look, the reason Social Security, the reason that, you know, Bush wanted to privatize, basically to, you know, dismantle Social Security, is not because he thought the program doesn't work. It's actually because the program does work, and it makes people think better of government.
Let's talk about the thesis. The basic thesis in the book is that normally we would have thought that economics drives politics, but the thesis here is, in fact, that politics drives economics. First of all, is that a new thesis to you? And secondly, one way or the other, how did you come to that?
Okay, it's a thesis I've been working towards for past 7-8 years. I came to it basically because that's where a lot of people who research the long-term trends in inequality have gotten. So you go back, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I grew up in the America of the 50s and the 60s, which was, in, you know, many things to criticize about the society, but it was broadly middle class. There was a relative equality of economic condition among Americans. We've known since for a number of years now that that middle class society was created politically, didn't gradually evolve. It wasn't that, you know, in 1900 we were a gilded age, and by 1925 we were halfway to being a middle class society, and by 1950 it's Ozzie and Harriet. What actually happened was that right up until Franklin Roosevelt, the Gilded Age was, in economic terms, full flower. It was a society of vast inequalities between top and middle and bottom. And in a few years, thanks to pro-labor government policies, pro-labor union, Social Security, unemployment insurance, minimum wage, and a lot of equalizing policies followed during World War II, we just emerged quite suddenly as a middle-class society. So we know historically the movement towards greater equality that took place in the 30s and 40s was political, and there's a growing amount of evidence that the move towards growing inequality that has taken place since the 1970s is also political.
In that pan of your book, you're called an iconoclast, and I'm just curious, are you really, when it comes to this, are a lot of economists agreeing with you on this?
Sure. The big premier researchers in long-term trends in U.S. inequality are Emmanuel Saez, actually, at Berkeley, and Thomas Piketty in France. That's what they say. They actually believe that it's largely political. They point out, that international comparisons show that the United States is unique in having this explosion of inequality in the last couple of decades. No other advanced country has seen it. They point out that the move towards greater equality took place very suddenly, which other economists have done. So this is actually the leading researchers in this area say this. Peter Temin and Frank Levy at MIT have a very influential recent study where they argue that the growing inequality of American society in recent decades is the result of the collapse of what they call the Treaty of Detroit. The deal between corporations and labor unions that lasted for several decades after World War II and then came apart basically during Reagan. So no, actually I'm not at all out of where the current research is.
Talk about that Detroit incident in particular.
In the 1940s, you know, there was a time Walter Reuther, United Auto Workers, was a very important force, and there was a period when there were, you know, big strikes and enormous conflict between the auto companies and the UAW. And finally, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, they reached a modus vivendi. And the deal was, we will have labor peace, we won't have a lot of strikes, and in return, we're going to have wages that rise as productivity rises. We're going to have solid benefits. We're basically going to make auto workers middle-class citizens. And that did it for the auto workers for a long time, and it spread to a lot of the economy. So you can look and see that in many other industries, whether they had strong unions or not, if there were strong unions, they looked for a settlement, something like what the UAW had gotten. If they didn't, employers felt that they had to more or less match those settlements in order not to get unionized. So you had this general, no, it wasn't socialism. It wasn't a level distribution of income, but it was something which was a kind of guarantee that the fruits of economic progress would be shared with workers in return for labor peace for the employers.
Another issue in what you call the Great Compression, is that a term that you...
No, that's not mine. That's, again, okay. It's good solid economists. Claudia Golden of Harvard and Robert Margo have this fabulous... okay, you have to be a real economics wonk to consider a fabulous claim, but they have a classic paper from 1991 about how middle-class America emerged, and they looked, you know, very hard at the data, and it all happens in their data between 1938 and 1945, and the title of the paper is The Great Compression.
What role in the Great Compression did the graduated income tax have on equality? It seems to me that if you're going to be taxed for 90% of your income, if you're making $10 million, and you're going to be taxed for a lot less, if you're making a lot less, What's the point of asking for $10 million? It'll all be confiscated.
Now, there is, right, by the way, listeners may not know, but, you know, back in the days when that socialist Dwight Eisenhower was president, the top tax rate was, in fact, 91%. Look, corporate CEOs, the most spectacular explosion of income at the top has come for CEOs. They appoint the boards that set their pay, so there is always this possibility of insider dealing. And why was there less insider dealing once upon a time? You know, right now we just had Stanley O'Neill of Merrill Lynch basically ran the company into the ground, and in punishment he gets to retire with $159 million settlement. But anyway, but the question you ask is why wasn't there more insider dealing? Why were in the 60s and early 70s, why were CEO salaries only 30 times that of the average worker, as opposed to 350 times or 500 times now? Part of the answer is there were effective countervailing forces. There were unions that would protest. There were politicians who would hold hearings if you know, paid yourself obscene salary. But the other thing was, you know, was it worth it? You might be disrupting the company, and anyway, you were paying in the 50s a 90% tax rate on the extra money. Even through the 70s, it was still 70%. So it wasn't that, and that actually shows up, by the way, in the academic work. You can find some influence of high marginal tax rates and limiting runaway executive salaries.
I think what struck me most about the first half of your book, Paul Krugman, Conscience of a Liberal, is actually how liberal society was during that period. We kind of forget now. We look at it, you know, I mean, obviously you and I grew up and came of age at the same
right.
time. We rebelled in the late 60s to one degree or another, but things seemed awfully fair at that point, and the rancor was so much less.
You know, I remember people going around demonstrating against evil corporations and America with a K in 1968, 1969, and you look at the corporations of that era, and they're like little socialist republics compared with the corporations of this era. There were many things wrong with America. You know, we don't want to forget about racism and sexism, which were much more prevalent then than they are now. But in terms of economics, the rich weren't all that rich. The middle class, the working class, was solidly middle class in a way it is not now. And sure, there was a lot more. We were much more of a democracy in an economic sense than we are now. And I would actually argue in some ways more of a democracy in a political sense, too.
Well, a lot of people would
yeah.
also after what we saw in the last three elections
yeah.
up till 2006. I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, of course, these movement conservatives, as you call them,
which is what they call themselves, by the
okay.
way, that people say, are you part of the conservative movement or are you a movement conservative? So it's the line I use. And, yes, Virginia, there is a vast right-wing conspiracy, and they'll tell you so. So, yeah.
In reading your book, I mean, I follow how the philosophy permeated, how the media slowly was co-opted, how through various propagandistic forums things changed.
Right.
What do economists, the more orthodox economists, say? Do they just say suddenly laissez-faire became, for whatever reason, the thing to believe in because it's there? I mean, how do they justify the change?
Well, there's actually, academic economics is a lot less ideological than people imagine. And in some funny ways, during the Reagan years, when you might have had the impression that free market ideology was sweeping, everything off there. You know, at that point, I was just a pretty narrowly academic. And what we were doing was actually, there was a lot of stuff about the possible reasons for government intervention, about, I did my own academic career on something called the New Trade Theory, which was really questioning some of the orthodoxy about international trade, though not in a simple protectionist way. So you really want to make a distinction. The economists that you see on TV became very right-wing, but surprise, that's the same process. Supply-side economics never had a significant following. There are no supply-side economists even at the University of Chicago. It's a crank doctrine. Bush's own economic advisor, Greg Mankiw, before he became politically ambitious, wrote in his textbook, he called supply-side economics charlatans and cranks. It's really what we're seeing is the political process distorts the information that the public receives, not so much that the academics got co-opted.
Which brings us to the vast right-wing conspiracy, which I discovered doing a blog in which I criticized David Brooks and John Tierney. They would present experts on various issues. Tierney was focused mostly on private schools and school vouchers. And then I would go online and spend quite a bit of time actually following the money,
right,
following who these people were. And it's fascinating. The Olin Foundation, the Bradley Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute, you follow all of them and you come back to the same four or five money sources.
That's right. It's the I think there's the five sisters, the foundations that support a lot. And I talk about that in Conscience of a Liberal. I talk about the think tanks and their common... There are dozens of think tanks, but they all have the same benefactors. I always thought that the right-wing stuff about George Soros, how he's behind everything, is partly that they're just demonizing, as partly they're, you know, he's clearly, you know, he's somebody who needs to be perfected, as Ann Coulter would say, and they're playing on that a little bit. But it's also, that's the way things work in their world. The idea that an evil billionaire is coordinating everything is, well, that isn't that the way the world works? It's the way the world works on our side.
The politics of projection.
Yeah. So, and no, it's very real. If you look and you see, and it influences not just, you know, not just the ideas that show up in opinion columns. It's a big thing for political careers. If you're going to be a Republican politician, there's always the possibility you might lose an election. What's waiting for you? Well, if you're a not loyal, a double plus ungood Republican like Lincoln Chafee, not much. If you're Rick Santorum, there's a think tank, a right-wing think tank with funding from the usual sources, ready there to offer you a job, a chair as head of the new America's Enemies program. And that's in fact exactly what happened.
And also the punditocracy supported primarily by, you know, Fox News. However, there was never much of a left-wing. In fact, there was no left-wing punditocracy. We never saw Molly Ivins or you on the air.
That's right. I very rarely for me, Molly just about never, and Molly was so so funny, so effective a presence that you would have thought that the networks would be dying to have her on, but no, she wasn't there. Look, even now, you look at panel on the Sunday talk shows. Well, I was on Stephanopoulos recently, so I can't say it's 100%, but by and large, and particularly, you know, you get something like, let's have a panel of experts to discuss the situation in Iraq, and it'll be a panel of experts that range all the way from liberal hawks to conservative hawks. There won't be anybody who was actually against the war beforehand, and it does come back to there is, a lot of it is money. The vast right-wing conspiracy, which is not hidden, it's not a secret star chamber, is held together very largely by money. The expression, wingnut welfare. You know that there's a paycheck waiting, whatever happens.
You're listening to an interview with Paul Krugman, whose latest book is Conscience of a Liberal. You were on Bill Maher a couple of weeks ago, going head-to-head with Tucker Carlson,
yeah.
A guy who, as it turns out, has absolutely no reason to be a pundit other than the fact that his father got him his initial job.
Yeah.
It was fascinating to watch him in action because he just kept blabbing, even though what he was saying made no sense.
Right. No, it was kind of like the Chewbacca defense from The Simpsons, or the lawyer thing. If the law's on your side, pound the law. If the facts are on your side, pound the facts. Otherwise, pound the table. Just keep yelling. It made no sense at all. But that's fairly typical, and you can see it all the time. It's hard. One of the problems with being a liberal or a progressive, which I think are, you know, different versions of the same thing, is that you actually tend to be a reasonable person. And this sometimes puts you at a disadvantage.
I interviewed you 3 years ago, and one question I asked you, and I've asked a few people the same question, which was, do these people actually believe what they're saying? And at the time, your response was, well, gee whiz, I don't know them. And now 3 years have passed, and you've met a lot of them, and you've seen them in action. Do they even believe what they're saying?
I think for the most part, no. Although, remember, very few people are self-aware enough to say to themselves, I'm saying this because it's a living, and I don't believe a bit of it. You know, and very few people are self-aware enough. You know, they're not a lot of people sitting in rooms and, you know, twirling their mustaches and saying, he, boy, I'm fooling. But I don't think there's much deep conviction. This thing, movement conservatism, you know, it has its roots going all the way back to National Review in the 50s, Goldwater, but it really becomes institutionalized in the 1970s. I talk about that a lot in the book. That's 35 years ago, and there's always been lots of money behind it. And so the current generation, the Tucker Carlsons of this world, if you like, they're apparatchiks who've grown up inside the movement their whole lives. They probably don't even think much about whether it is they believe. You know, it's their job. And it's an assured living. You become a college Republican. And the president of the college Republicans is a well-paid job. So right from the beginning, you know, you basically make a living out of espousing an ideology. Do you really believe in it? I probably don't think they even think about that very much.
When you're there on the show with him and you're looking over at Marr, does Marr know or sense that they don't believe what they're saying?
Yeah. Bill Marr is a funny guy who actually I think does have some deeply held beliefs. And he does, you know, he wants the fireworks. He wants the yelling because it keeps people watching. But, I was on Bill Maher 4 years previous. And at that point, they had Jesse Ventura, which was even in some ways worse, but also someone who, I can't remember her name, but another sort of, clearly somebody who's just, you know, making a living by pretending to be a deeply committed conservative. Ann Coulter, I'm sure, doesn't believe a word she says. She's just it's just the money.
What about someone like Andrew Sullivan?
You know, I think he has some real convictions, but the trouble is he's also fallen in. It's a long story. I mean, he was a crazy warmonger at the worst, and pursued me personally quite a lot, and now he's repented, but he still hasn't accepted the fact that it wasn't just this one thing. That really the people he put his faith in are across the board just not patriots.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago Ken Auletta was on this show, and he'd written an article that appeared in his most recent book about the role that money plays just in terms of corporate functions, $25,000, $50,000, $100,000, that if you're a right-winger, even if the Olin Foundation isn't supporting you, you can make hundreds of thousands of dollars just doing boilerplate speeches.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of that. You know, one thing, money in politics in general. People talk about campaign finance, as they should, but that's not the whole of it. I mean, I think a lot of the way the influence is exerted is much, it's a lot more raw than that. Billy Towson, former Congressman Billy Towson, who shepherded the Medicare bill in 2003, a dreadful but pro-drug industry bill through, and wrote it exactly the way the drug industry wanted it. That wasn't because he needed the campaign contributions. It was because as soon as the term was up, he stepped down and became the head of the pharmaceutical lobby at a salary of $2 million a year. So is that raw, how the system actually works?
Paul Krugman, in Conscience of a Liberal, bringing this up to the present, you talk about something called bourbon Democrats from the turn of the century, people who were Democrats yet at the same time were closely in line with the politics of the wealthy. And when I look at, say, Lieberman or Feinstein today, am I seeing anything different?
No, not really. I mean, we certainly have our Bourbon Democrats today. You know, Joe Lieberman, actually, what I think I see and what the ratings tell me is that he's actually voted relatively liberal on a lot of things, although not seems when it matters. So bankruptcy reform. He voted against it, but voted foreclosure anyway. No, that's right. In the Gilded Age, there were Democrats who, although there was a populist streak in the party, there were any Democrats who really made it big in politics were ones who were very nearly as much in the service of the robber barons as the Republicans. And that's why I wrote in the New York Times a few columns back that one great concern for Democrats is we hope we're about to elect another Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but we might be about to elect another Grover Cleveland. And that's the classic example.
Nobody in the press is asking Hillary if she's going to roll back the Bush tax cuts.
I thought it's fairly clear, I don't know if it's explicit or not, I believe it's explicit, that that's how she's going to pay for health care. Now, her program is sounding quite progressive. Her program is basically whatever John Edwards said 6 months later, is I think the way to describe it, which is better than never. And so everybody's question is, well, what about in office? And I have no way of judging that. I mean, what she said she's going to do is actually pretty good. What she would actually do, well, we may, more likely than not, we're going to find out.
Well, I noticed that anything Bush says is completely meaningless at this point and has been for a long time. It's kind of interesting. The press takes what the Bush administration says still at face value, yet questions everything Hillary Clinton says.
Oh, yes. Well, there's a problem with the press, which is part of it may be corporate interests that control parts of the media. And part of it is what I can tell you about it firsthand, which is what I call asymmetrical intimidation. To criticize Bush, even now, even to criticize him correctly, truthfully, you're going to face a hailstorm of harassment of various kinds. And they're going to go after you personally as a journalist. They're going to try and discredit you. They're going to try and ruin your life if they possibly can, ruin your career. Whereas you can say completely untrue or, you know, nonsensical stuff about a Democrat, especially a strongly progressive Democrat, and there's no accountability. And so you get this, how many stories did we see about Hillary Clinton's laugh? You know, which, my God, what's that about? And at the same time, they were amazing. Just even if we're just going to do revealing personal things, when Mitt Romney said that his sons were serving the country by helping him become president, as far as I could make out, aside from my mentioning it in the column, there were no mentions in major news sources. That struck me as an astonishingly revealing thing about the sheer self-centeredness of this guy.
Paul Krugman, let's go to that review in the New York Times, because I think watching how someone criticizes you tells us, in a way, more about them, of course, yeah, than it does about you. We have an interesting statement here. What Kennedy says is, "Where the Orthodox see nothing but market miracles, Krugman sees many a market failure. And where they detect the invisible hand, Krugman finds manipulation by the richest Americans to rig the game in their favor." Now, I'm looking at that, and I've been watching the system for the past 20 years, and the manipulation by the rich should be pretty obvious to everybody, including people watching Fox News.
Yeah, I mean, you may remember, since you're here, that there was this energy crisis in California. And I was one of the few people saying, you know, there's clear circumstantial evidence of market manipulation going on here, and was dismissed as a conspiracy theorist for that. And then eventually the evidence just became too strong. And then we got the tapes, and you can actually hear the Enron people calling up the power station saying, we need the price to go up, shut that thing down. But I think it's amazing for anyone to not see that manipulation. One of the more telling statistical stories, I think, out there is to look at what happened to unions in America versus what happened to unions in other advanced countries. So the U.S. and Canada in the 1960s, in both countries, about 30% of workers were in unions. In Canada, it's still almost 30%. In the U.S., of course, it's down to about 11 and mostly in public sector. How did that happen? Well, what happened was that the federal government basically turned anti-union. It declared open season for employers trying to block union organizers. Now, that looks to me like manipulation of the system on behalf of the rich.
Well, how does a middle-of-the-road historian of note, how does he write such things? Where does that come from?
Well, all right, you know, I actually got some notes from other historians saying that this looked like the most raw case of professional jealousy they've ever seen. So, my last book had a review, also in the New York Times Book Review, where the guy made fun of me for suggesting that the Bush administration is corrupt, saying, oh, you can't prove that. Look, it's the same syndrome that makes people in Washington consider you unsound on national security if you weren't in favor of the Iraq war. Even though they all admit that actually was a terrible mistake, you weren't supposed to notice that too soon. That makes you unreliable. So actually, in the end of that review in the Times, the guy basically says, well, you know, he's right that we have crazy right-wingers running the Republican Party, but it's not okay to suggest that, you know, there's something really deep going on there. It's very, very peculiar.
It reminds me of what that phrase from years ago, premature anti-fascist.
And yes, I think about that phrase all the time. And for what it's worth, by the way, there are a raft of letters, not from me, coming in the Times Book Review, and every one of them trashes the reviewer.
He did hit something, though. The Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. You conflated the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act.
You know, I refer to them many, many times, and there's a whole elaborate discussion, and once I have the date wrong.
That's
and he picked, and he went after me on prohibition, saying it doesn't originate in Kansas, but, you know, it did. They were the first state to put prohibition in the Constitution, and Carrie Nation, with her acts, was in Kansas. So I don't know what's going on in his mind.
Okay, now what about this one? Because I think this deserves an answer from you.
Yeah.
He writes, "For this dismal state of affairs, the Democratic Party is held to be blameless. Never mind the Democrats' embrace of inherently divisive identity politics, or democratic condescension toward the ungrammatical yokels who consider their spiritual and moral commitments no less important than the minimum wage or the Endangered Species Act, nor even the Democrats' vulnerable post-Vietnam record on national security, which you go into in some depth.
Yeah, I go into – so let's just talk about the other things.
Okay.
The whole religion, values, condescension – first of all, I'm not noticing a whole lot of condescension towards religion on the part of the Democratic Party. You know, this is – you can find some people who are condescending, but have they ever been the Democratic nominee for president? You know, what's going on here?
The more panderers I've seen.
Yeah. Beyond that, I mean, there's a lot of political science research. Particularly, I'm a big fan of Larry Bartels, who's my colleague at Princeton, and he has a paper which is a critique of Tom Frank. But aside from that, it's called What's the Matter with Kansas? But in which he really looks at what are the trends in opinion, and there's remarkably little evidence of religion having been an important swing factor. Almost everything that you see is really about just one thing. Almost all the change in voting, which is the switch of white Southerners from the Democrats to the Republicans. So you see a lot of religious voters switching parties, but that's mainly the Southerners switching. One way of cutting through all of this is a great statistic from Larry Bartels. In 1952, we all know white men have left the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party is weak on national security, all these things. In 1952, if you look at non-Southern white men, 40% voted Democratic. In 2004, non-Southern white men, 39% voted Democratic. This whole thing, once you take the South out, it just disappears. And so Kennedy, the reviewer, is going through all of these things, which he knows are true, but he hasn't actually looked at the data, looked at the facts, and turns out that none of them are true.
How did he get the gig?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that the editor of the Times Book Review is working on the authorized biography of William F. Buckley. But who knows? I mean, book reviewing is, you know, famously. If there are any authors who haven't gotten some review that they think is wildly crazy and disrespectful, then they can't have been out there very long.
Well, let's talk about two people, though, who have been treading on similar ground. One is Thomas Frank.
Right.
Which you find his material pretty good, but...
What's the Matter with Kansas is a wonderful book, and it captures the absurdity and the harshness of everything that's happening very, very well. But he emphasizes the values issues. He emphasizes abortion and religion and homosexuality. And what I take from political scientists who've crunched the data quite a lot is that most of those things are less powerful than he imagines. And oddly, Tom does not talk about race. And I believe the data point very strongly to race rather than religion as being at the core of how a basically unpopular economic agenda has been able to win elections.
And the other is the work of George Lakoff.
Yeah, again, there's the, you know, George talks about the framing, and it's certainly true, and I think, you know, Democrats, progressives need to learn that. I was really encouraged, actually, in the S-CHIP debate. I think George wrote about this as well, that finally, it was the Democrats who had real human examples. Look at this 12-year-old boy. Look at this 3-year-old girl. And the Republicans who were trying to talk numbers and abstract. But again, you know, once you bear in mind that you can explain almost everything that happened by Southern whites started voting Republican, then there isn't that much left over to explain with framing and all of these issues.
But there was also the fact that Congress did go Republican.
Well, but that, again, you look at the I actually do this in Conscience of Liberal. If you look at the Democrats had a majority in 1954 that was almost in the House that was exactly the same as the Republican majority in after the 2004 elections. Where did that switch come? And the answer is more than all of it came from the Southern switch. The Republicans had actually lost seats in the North over that 50-year period. They'd been entirely the Southern switch. And, of course, now we have a Democratic majority in the House that is larger than the Republicans had at any point during their 12-year reign, and it's a pretty solidly progressive majority.
What about two issues? One is vote fraud, and the other is getting out the vote, the loss of the unions on the one hand and the rise of the churches on the other.
Yeah, no, that's a real issue. Both are real issues. The vote fraud, that's the scariest thing. Actually, Rush Holt, the vote reformer, is my congressman. And he says, people say, well, there's no evidence that electronic fraud has swung any elections. And he says, how would you know? There is a real concern. Now, as it turns out, 2006, the actual vote totals were not too far off what the opinion polls have been showing beforehand. So it suggests at least in that election there wasn't that much fraud going on. But yeah, I mean, that's the great concern. I think we need a cutting edge technology on voting. It's called paper ballots, counted by hand with as many people watching as possible. This is the way, this is the way France does it because they've had a long history of fraud, and so they know the importance of a pure vote, and we should go that way. Get out the vote. Yeah, it's actually inconscient of a liberal. If the union movement was as strong now as it was in the 60s, we would have substantially higher voting rates. There's a clear connection. Both union members and their families and the people they know become more likely to vote, and that would need much stronger representation of lower-income Americans, and it would move our political balance substantially in a progressive direction.
In terms of getting out the vote by the churches, this is my own belief, and you're free to tell me that I'm completely insane, but my feeling is that if you have the three major candidates in the Republican Party being Rudy Giuliani, who the churches won't go for, Mitt Romney, who's a Mormon, and John McCain. My feeling is McCain's going to be the candidate.
I don't think there's a route by which that can happen, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
And Giuliani, I mean, this in a way, it's almost a test case, because Giuliani on a religion, moral values, if that was really what's crucial, then you could hardly do worse, right? And he's, I think he's had more divorces than the entire Democratic field and, all of that. But if it's really about race, then Giuliani has a well-deserved reputation as being someone prepared to crack down in a punitive way on you-know-who.
On the other hand, he's got Norman Podhoretz as his advisor.
Oh, boy.
Podhoretz is nuts.
Well, this is – no, I mean, Giuliani scares me. And Norman Podhoretz and other people around, but Podhoretz in particular with we're in World War IV, and we need to start bombing Iran and – well, I made a little – I wrote recently about this whole Islamo-fascism thing. Is crazy. There is no such thing. There are religious fanatics. There are brutal dictators. They're not the same people. And a part of the reason, and I did write this, is that it appeals so much. It's not just a way to justify why it was that we invaded Iraq rather than going after Al-Qaeda. It's also, generic fear of dark-skinned people. So it all circles back to the same stuff.
Paul Krugman. I interviewed Jeffrey Toobin about his book on the Supreme Court not long ago. He said that because of the Internet, he feels that we're in a media golden age.
Oh, wow. The media were never as good as we imagine, I suppose. But there was just a Pew study of election coverage so far in this cycle. And it was horrifying, although not too surprising. Almost all the stories are about horse race politics. Back in 2004, I did a study. I wanted to know what somebody getting his news from TV would know about the Bush versus the Kerry healthcare plans, which were not as different as the Democratic and Republican plans are now, but still very, very different. And the answer, after surveying, I went through 2 months of all the cable networks, all of the broadcast networks, the answer was nothing, not one thing. There were several stories on how the healthcare plans were playing politically, but nothing at all about what was in them. And now it turns out it's like that only more so this election, that there are, I think it's only 12% of reporting on the elections has anything to do with how the policies that the candidates are proposing might affect you. And the other 87% is all how it's playing politically or who's raising the most money. And public perception, just looking within the Democratic race, the public perception is that Hillary is the most is the furthest left and Edwards the furthest right. And that just tells you that the media are not doing their job.
Toobin also, of course, talks about the Supreme Court. And I wonder in this coming election is if anybody is going to talk about the fact that if a Republican, any Republican gets in, including Giuliani, this is a possibility that a lot of things that we take for granted could be overturned.
Yeah. I hope that it'll be talked about. I mean, I guess my belief is that if it does come down to Giuliani as the Republican nominee, well, it's a question. Assuming that the nation starts to hear anything of what everyone in New York knows, this guy will implode. I would bet that not one American in 10 has heard the name Bernie Kerik, let alone Alan Plaka. And
who's the other one?
Oh, he's the defrocked priest with the – anyway, I'm not going to go too far on that, but it's a Giuliani has some interesting associates, but it doesn't get reported. I think people will be afraid. In some ways, I'm almost more afraid of Mitt Romney, who you know comes across as reasonable. Although I wrote recently, if you look at the text of the ads he's running, they're stark raving mad. You know, these handful of terrorists in northwest Pakistan are going to collapse the United States and establish a world caliphate.
Let's talk about the end of the book, which is about health care. I think most people in America at this point no longer using the term socialized medicine. They seem to understand that it's got to do with insurance, and they seem to understand that our system has completely broken down.
Yeah, there's overwhelming support among the public for some kind of guarantee of health insurance. We'll find out how much of a democracy we are to see whether we get it. Now, there's a very strong economic argument for Medicare for all, single payer. You know, people say, well, Americans will never accept single payer, except Medicare is a single payer system and is very, very popular. But I think that actually is not the way to go, not on economic grounds, but on political grounds, because it does mean that people would have to take a bit of a leap into the unknown. They'd have to give up the coverage they have and exchange it for a government program. So I'm willing to accept a transition where people get to keep the coverage they have, but we have regulation of private insurers, no pre-existing conditions can no longer be used to exclude coverage, where we have subsidies to people so they can afford to buy it, and we have a public plan that competes with private insurance. And that's basically what all of the leading Democrats are now proposing. We know it can work. There are systems like that in some European countries that work. I think the public's about ready for it. I don't think they're going to be bullied into, you know, with tales of socialized medicine. By the way, Ronald Reagan made recordings for the American Medical Association denouncing proposals for Medicare as socialized medicine, circa 1960. And those didn't work. So I think in this time it won't work either.
You, in most of your columns in the past year, have been right on when it came to the subprime bubble and what would happen. It looks like we may be entering another tech bubble, and are we in for a fall?
Well, it hasn't gone far enough in the text that the fall would hurt us that much. I don't think it's likely. Well, it's not. So far, it's nothing like the same size. I mean, it would be very visible here in the Bay Area, but I think it's less so elsewhere. And housing is just big. You know, you want to bear in mind that we have the total value of housing is on the order of $20 trillion, and it's, by some estimates, there's high estimates, but the high estimates say it may be as much as 50% overvalued. So we're talking about very, really big stuff on housing. Tech I'll worry about later.
And the deficit caused by Bush's war?
All right. The war is, relative to things we ought to be doing, it's enormously expensive. The cost of this S-CHIP expansion is 41 days of Iraq for 5 years of children's health coverage. So this is absurd. Now, but relative to the size of the economy, you have to look, you know, we're talking about the latest Congressional Budget Office estimates are up to $2.4 trillion. And all right, a trillion here, a trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money. But the war is, the way I like to think of it is that as a share of the economy, the war is about a tenth what we were spending on the military during the height of the Cold War. It's about half of what we were spending on Vietnam during the height of the Vietnam War. So it's big, but it's not crippling. And it's by itself, it's not going to cause a crisis, which is not to say, again, that this isn't an outrageous waste.
And how about China's vast holdings in the U.S.?
Well, that's an interesting. John Maynard Keynes once said, if you owe the bank £1,000, you have a problem. If you owe the bank £1,000,000, the bank has a problem. I'm not sure, with China having roughly $1 trillion of U.S. debt, I'm not sure who has the leverage there. You know, I think they may be more in trouble than we are, because if we can always just say, no, we're not paying. And what are they going to do, send gunboats?
Paul Krugman, your own history, you were an economist who got the job of doing a column on economy, the economy that eventually turned into a political column. In Conscience of a Liberal, you credit Gail Collins, who was the then editor of the editorial page, for keeping you there. Was there any kind of impetus to remove you?
I have no idea. I do know that there was a lot of pressure being brought for me and everybody else. You know, so we have Chris Matthews now saying that the White House kept on calling his bosses to tell him to shut up to Muslim. And Chris Matthews, needless to say, was not nearly taking the kind of line I was taking. So I assume that there was, and I got the sense that there was a fair bit of pressure. Not sure that another newspaper would have stood up. Time's dead. I mean, you look at, think about somebody like Bob Scheer, who was totally right on these issues and got dropped from the L.A. Times. They were difficult times. On the other hand, I do sell papers, which is one good thing in my favor, I think.
Do you think that because you and Frank Rich were so forthright so early, it made the financial idea of Time Select possible?
Well, it turns out not to have exactly been possible anyway.
Oh, well, yeah.
Right? But possibly. I mean, the Times editor, well, now that the paywall is down, you can see that the most read, most emailed do tend to be the opinion columnists. And including, I have to say, when David Brooks doesn't defend the Bush administration and writes some observations on modern life, a lot of people like to read him. So, I think we're a profit center over there on the op-ed page.
Is that one of the reasons that the new columnists, Roger Cohen and Gail Collins, are not right-wingers?
I can't talk too much about Times business, partly because I don't follow it that much. One of the mysteries has been actually why many news organizations are not following the money on, why isn't MSNBC looking for two, three Manny Obermans? You look at the ratings, and that's where they ought to be going. And instead, or why isn't CNN trying to find themselves somebody like that? Instead, they're still thinking that they have to, be Fox Lite. And the trouble is, actually, you can't out Fox Fox.
You've become a celebrity over the past 3 or 4 years. How does it affect you personally, you think?
Not that much.
Really?
Partly because I'm not that much of a celebrity. I mean, one of my favorite scenes was getting, accosted in a restaurant in New York by someone who said, won't you know, you're my favorite columnist, and The World is Flat is your best book yet. So so it's not that much. No, it doesn't, I don't hang around in D.C. I take the subway when I go to New York. So, no, it doesn't affect. I have a quiet life.
Paul Krugman, do you have any areas that you plan to be focusing in, new areas in your columns coming up?
I'm getting first of all, we'd have healthcare is going to be central. I really want to talk about that quite a lot. And housing, we got to figure out what's going to happen. I'm getting very interested and a little bit alarmed at actually tech issues, because the U.S. is, while we've been so busy fighting gay married terrorists, we've actually been falling behind on broadband access. It's really quite striking how we've sort of taken for granted that we own the internet, and actually turns out we've screwed up regulatory policy there, screwed up access, and seem to be falling behind. So that's one of the areas I'll be looking at, and maybe we can even start to talk a little bit about global economy as the Bush era fades away.
Well, how about global economy in the face of rising oceans?
Well, yes, environmental. I'm trying to figure out a way to do that. I mean, it's very hard to write about those things in a way that isn't just preaching to the converted and to convey some new information, but I think about it.
Are you working on another book?
At the moment, I'm working on second edition of Principles of Economics with Robin Wells, because in my other life, I am a textbook author, so I actually have, for the moment, that's all that's in process. I don't want to think about another public book until that's done.
Okay, this is a question which is not going to be in there, but I did ask one of the people who I've been sending your emails to. I said, do you have any question for Paul Krugman?
Yeah.
And she said she's always fascinated by philanthropy and I guess the pros and cons of the fact that all of these wealthy people are giving money. Are there any books about it that she could read?
Oh, wow. I'm pretty sure there is, but I can't remember. Actually, the book you might want to look at to get a kind of – it's not quite on this, but I want to – things I was actually looking at is, when Bush said he was a compassionate conservative, it was what the Brits called dog whistle politics. It was actually referring to the work of Marvin Alasky, if you run across him, a Christian right author who actually is opposed to the welfare state. So Bush wasn't actually saying, I think we should keep the social safety net. He was actually saying we should go back to the Gilded Age when people had to depend on the charity of rich people, which was good for the souls of the rich people. And this is so. Anyway, there have been some, but I don't know them.
You've been listening to an interview with Paul Krugman, whose latest book is Conscience of a Liberal. Paul Krugman can be read in the New York Times every Friday and Monday at this point. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.